That's why you do these things. In other words, you want to leave it better than you got it.
But at the same time, you've never been a fan of a gigantic budget deficit, and that's what a lot of people feel we're faced with. And I know the issue is, can we grow out of this? And you and I are both pro-growth. But isn't, Larry, even if you're pro-growth, the numbers are so staggering. The deficit is so daunting.
Well, I don't know. You know, yeah, gigantic deficits are not good.
Hi, it's the Reason Podcast. I am Catherine Mangu-Ward, editor-in-chief of Reason, filling in for Matt Welsh, who is in a French chateau right now. I am joined today by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, somewhere in Los Angeles. Say hi to the people, Nick.
I am somewhere in Los Angeles, and I can deliver proof of life if necessary.
And in D.C., we have Peter Suderman and special guest star Stephanie Slade, managing editor of Reason Magazine, who is going to be acting as our moral conscience as well as the voice of reason, even among the voice of reason. Say hi, Slade.
That's a tall order you just gave me.
I mean, that's what you do every day. I'm sure it'll be fine. Okay, Larry Kudlow is asked a totally anticipatable question at a conference last week. He gives us a big long pause and then says, deficits are okay. Peter, are deficits okay?
No. No. So what's really interesting about this is that go back about a month at the end of June, Larry Kudlow was quoted as saying, look, because of the tax law, deficits are already going down. They're on the way down, which is just not true at all. And in fact, when he was called on this, he said, well, what I meant was they're going to go down. And then if you look at a somewhat little noticed White House report that came out the end of last week, it was the new budget projections. They projected that the deficit was actually going to be going up $100 billion more each year versus what they previously projected, and that the deficit would be double what they initially projected in their FY 2018 budget for the 2018 fiscal year. And so it's going to be over $1 trillion versus the 500 and something billion dollars that they had projected initially. And that is in part because of the tax law. The tax law is not reducing the deficit. And then, of course, Republicans followed the tax law with a bipartisan big spending bill with Democrats that raised deficits by about $400 billion. And so it's really just sort of incredible to see that Larry Kudlow is not just a TV personality anymore. He's not just a conservative economic commentator. He is the National Economics Council director, the top economic advisor to the president. And he's saying, look, the deficits are already down. Well, OK, they're not already down. They're going to come down. Look, the tax law is going to work. We're going to get all this money back. This is actually also what Mitch McConnell said on the night that the Senate passed the tax law. And there's no evidence that this is true. It's not just CBO. It's not just the deficit hawks who are, sort of projecting this. This is in the White House's own budget. And Larry Kudlow can't seem to get it right. And doesn't really seem to care all that much.
No. And, you know, as a long time, Larry Kudlow was one of the pitch men. You know, he was like the Fuller brush man for supply side tax cuts for his entire public career, which is partly about, the idea that if you cut taxes, and there's some truth to this, I mean, certainly theoretically, but if you cut taxes in a way that spurs economic growth, you'll end up, you get a smaller percentage of each dollar made, but more dollars are out there, so you end up covering things. And you can even hear him in the clip say, oh, we're going to get it back. We're going to get it back. We're going to cut taxes, increase spending, but we're going to make it up on volume somehow. And he's a bullshit artist about that. He's also now talking about, we're going to see 3.5% economic growth annually and then 3% down the road, et cetera. These are all totally fanciful bullshit explanations. And I think there's two things to think about with this. One is that Trump, again, like Obama did this with Christina Romer, his head of the Economic Advisory Council, they make liars out of their advisors. They bring people in who are known for one thing. And Kudlow was going to be like a good, tough, free trade, pro-market kind of guy. And Trump brings him in and then kind of like makes him say the exact opposite of what he knows to be
true. Well, in this case, though, it's a little different because Larry Kudlow has, as you point out, consistently throughout his career said basically that tax cuts.
Right. But he's also been consistently free trade and he's been friendly to immigration. And now all of a sudden he's like, hey, you know what? Like protectionism isn't such a bad thing. et cetera. And the other point, which is actually, I think, more important, is to understand why deficits are a problem. Like a lot of people, and this used to be a Democratic thing where people would be like, the Republicans, you know, they're these green eye shade wearing, anal retentive people who just want balance in everything, or they want a surplus in government because they're cheap and they're chintzy, et cetera. Everybody now agrees, and this includes right-wing economists or pro-market economists from MIT, as well as actual Marxist economists who work at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, all agree that when you have persistent, massive deficits with no sign of that abating and higher and higher debt, debt overhang, that it reduces economic activity for years into the future. And we are already in a debt overhang situation and have been for a number of years where the debt as a percentage of GDP is larger than 90% of the economy. It's, you know, essentially more than 100% of the economy. And this is going to take decades to unwind. And it's one of the reasons almost certainly why we have lower than average economic growth. We see this in every country that experiences this. And Japan is our future. A country that is just racking up more and more debt and having lower and lower economic activity for decades. We are doing almost everything exactly the same as Japan did, which started its lost decade in like 1990. And we're doing this. And that's why deficits are not an accounting fixation or a kind of, you know, puritanical parsimony thing. They have real effects on future economic growth. And for all of you guys, because you're younger than me, it was nice knowing you, and I feel bad for you because I won't live as long into a shitty, low growth or no growth economic future. But you're stuck in it for the next 25 years.
So I think Peter makes a good point that Kudlow has, he is at least consistent on this theory of
supply side economics, cutting taxes and everybody and everything takes.
Yeah,
care
but
of
you know,
itself.
It's not surprising that he would argue that cutting taxes is sort of pro growth. But what's amazing is that he's actually going much farther than that, and he's saying that like if you invest the spendings in a smart, effective way, like Obama spent the money badly, but we're going to spend the money right, and therefore the deficit spending is itself going to be pro-growth. So this is like, I mean, it's just incredible to see somebody who's ostensibly on the right just go full Keynesian, you know, deficit spending. Like, this is a good thing. This is gonna put money in people's pockets because the government's gonna spend it for you.
I mean, the idea of, you know, government investing in a thing that's going to grow the economy. Like, is there?
Hey,
that is
that
wall, ever
not
think of bullshit?
How many
I guess
jobs,
sometimes it's not bullshit.
How many jobs is that wall going to build?
So many jobs. All the jobs.
You're going to need coyotes on the Mexican side and on the American side, and then you're going to have to maintain the wall. And think of all the litter that's going to be along the wall, you know, both human bodies and water bottles and stuff. I think it's going to be a net job generator.
The wall is the future of work. No, there is really a weird overlap and parallel between the kind of stimulus spending left and the tax cutting supply side right, and the ways that they basically both think that the key to boosting the economy is to run up huge deficits and have the government either through tax cuts or through government spending. And I don't want to say that those are exactly the same, but just in sort of sheer budgetary effects, they are functionally the same. And the idea that you can cut taxes without cutting spending, create a huge deficit, that is basically that's basically the stimulus theory of the economy. And it's particularly kind of strange to see it, although relatively consistent given the sort of the history of supply-siderism. It's strange to see it in a time when the economy is pretty much booming. The sort of the best version of Keynesianism, and I don't subscribe to it, but the one that makes the most sense is that you should spend and run up deficits during times of economic crisis, right? And that what you're doing is just sort of filling in the economic productivity gap that has bottomed out in the economy. What the Trump administration is doing, what Republicans have done under Trump, is to cut taxes and to run up the deficit in a time when the economy is already doing pretty well and when deficits were falling in the back half of the Obama administration. And so they have chosen to do this in a way that makes no sense according to really any theory.
Here is, let me to give Kudlow, like all of us, is a prisoner of his youth. And there was in 1980 when Reagan took office, Post-war debt to GDP was actually at a low. It was like around 30% or 35-36%. And that's not a problem. And you could argue, you know, that the government, that we could, the economy could sustain some large debt creation. But by 1995, actually in the early 90s, it cracked 60% of GDP. It's now over 100%. So what Kudlow was saying may have been at least defensible in 1980. It is absolutely insane to be talking in 2018 when the debt to GDP ratio, and you know that Kudlow knows this and that he believes in it, that, you know, large persistent deficits without any kind of fiscal reform to entitlement spending and long-term cost projections is death to an economy. It's a slow death to the economy. But for him to be acting as if in 2018, it's 1980 all over again, or even 1988, it's, you know, the charitable, you know, reading of that is that he's kind of brain dead.
But you're giving us like a soft reading of the plausibility of doing these things in 80 and or 88. I mean, you're old, Nick, as Matt would say for a
I'm
segue.
I'm very old. Yes.
Like,
yes.
Weren't, I guess my question is like, did people not have the same reaction at the time? Like when yes. initial revenues started to drop?
They did. They did, but the difference was, and actually what happened is Reagan came in and he enacted a bunch of very, you know, very large tax cuts and then clawed a lot of them back because the economy did not come out of recession immediately and the deficit started going up. And you even had people like Andy Warhol has a famous painting or a semi-famous painting about Reagan and deficits. Even Andy Warhol, who like lived on his Diners Club International card, he was worried about deficits. What had happened is that by the end of the Reagan years, the economy had come back and spending had increased in absolute terms, but the debt to GDP ratio, or rather not debt to GDP ratio, but the annual deficit had started to shrink as a percentage of GDP, which it also did under Bill Clinton towards the end of his, the end of his 8 years, mostly because the Republican Congress and Bill Clinton both agreed the era of big government was over and they had a roaring economy. But I agree. This is like saying, you know, the last tip of the Titanic is, you know, just above the waterline. And somebody saying, you know what, like, I mean, they're acting as if they're just getting off the dock in Southampton.
The lowest deficits in my lifetime came during the second Clinton term in the late 1990s. And those followed the George H.W. Bush tax hikes, the ones that he basically got booted out of office for. So they followed tax hikes and then they followed a spending restraint from the federal government. And so you had at the same time that you'd had tax hikes, you had the lowest spending as a percentage of GDP that we've seen in my lifetime. I was born in 1981, for those who are interested. And so that seems to be, in most cases, the path to a low deficit is modest tax hikes and real spending restraint. Instead, what we've had is tax cuts and no spending restraint.
Right. And under both Republicans and Democrats, remember that Obama extended, you know, like 90% or more of the Bush tax cuts that were enacted shortly after George W. Bush became president because they were popular. And it's ultimately about spending. I mean, this is where I've become over the past 15 years or so, especially, you know, it's about spending because taxes as a percentage of GDP have fluctuated. There was one or two years under Clinton where they cracked 20% of GDP. It's extremely, and that was because of capital gains reforms where people realized a lot of capital gains in order because the rates had come down. But basically, since World War II, tax revenue as a percentage of GDP, everything the government collects has gone between about 15 and 18%. Sometimes it gets up to 19, but very rarely. But spending is the variable. Spending can be anywhere from 15% to 40% under, you know, during World War II or something like that. Spending is the thing that we can control. And we can vary. And spending has not gone down. And that's the biggest, biggest problem.
Slade, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say this is yet more evidence that the sort of Republican starve the beast strategy just doesn't work, right? Like the idea that you can cut taxes and therefore government will take in less revenue and therefore government will be forced to spend less money. It just doesn't work that way. I mean, we've never seen that.
It also doesn't seem to work on the individual household level. Like I think the initial reason that argument had appeal was because you know, household debt, you know, consumer debt used to be harder to get. And so there was this sort of sense of like, on the individual level, you can only spend so much money you don't have before your imaginary money goes away. But now everyone everywhere has nearly infinite imaginary money, up to and including the U.S. government.
Well, the government even more so. And there's now a sort of running theory that effectively debt and deficits for the U.S. government don't matter because it can print its own money. And so this is, I think, the real long term.
They don't matter in terms of interest rates, but they do matter in terms of economic growth. And I think that's.
But that's not the theory that I'm talking about. Is right? Is there sort of the modern monetary sort of post-Keynesian theory? Is
this is what Dick Cheney said? Cheney in the early. In the early Bush years, when they were blowing out the budget like nobody's fucking business, Dick Cheney actually said Reagan proved deficits don't matter. And then it was off to the races.
But what Republicans are doing by running up the deficit like this in an all Republican Washington is they are going to pave the way for Democrats to come in, and the next time they have power, they're going to say, look, deficits don't matter at all. I mean, like, which was not something that. That Democratic leadership said under Obama. Now, I'm not saying they lived it, but they did bring the deficit down in the back half of his presidency, and they did go through a sort of bunch of they jumped through a bunch of hoops to make it look like Obamacare was paid for, you know. And so but the next time they're just going to say it doesn't matter at all. And so what Republicans are doing is creating an excuse for Democrats to come in and spend an awful lot more on, you know, Medicare for my dog.
So
do you want to know a truly heretical libertarian position that was first sketched out by Bill Niskanen, William Niskanen, a former Reagan economic advisor, as well as Peter Van Doren, who works at Regulation Magazine for Cato? Years ago, they noted that after tax increases, government spending tends to go down. And the theory behind that, and there's a correlation there, whether it's causation or not, but the theory of why it might be causative is when people are paying the full cost of government, they want less of it. So, you know, people purchase government services just like they purchase everything else. All things being equal, if the price goes up, you take less of it. And, you know, years ago for the Daily Beast, I wrote a thing about a Groupon thinking where we are basically at various points under Bush and Obama, we were borrowing as much as like 40 cents on every dollar of government spending. So like it's like a great discount where you're getting a buck of government services for 60 cents. You would be a jackass not to say, yeah, give me twice as much. And we need to fully price government because I think
a libertarian
perspective,
people feel the price of government. Slade was saying earlier, you know, it turns out that people don't, that people don't have the same kind of response to the, like the drowning the government in the bathtub thing doesn't work partially because people don't have a response to what
the
debt is available. But don't you think also thanks to withholding and other things that people don't have a sense of how much they're spending on government. They just don't know.
There's that, and a lot of education work has to go into saying, look, this is what government costs. If your taxes went up by 30% to basically fully account for the cost of government in a given year, think about it. Like if, and nobody knows what their marginal tax rate is. Nobody knows what their property tax rate is. I mean, it's so fucking hard to figure it out. But if you're suddenly getting a 30% larger cut in your paycheck, which is where it would show up because of withholding every week, and you go from, you know, $100 a week, you know, take home pay.
I think you're right. People would respond to a big change.
Yeah.
I actually would just point to surveys done on Medicare for All, and people, this Medicare for All single payer ends up being pretty popular, just sort of pulled by itself. And when you tell people that this would require significant tax hikes, it actually tends to flip and become not majority popular. And in fact, we've seen in several blue states, even in progressive states, even in places like Vermont, Bernie Sanders' home state, where they were working on a single payer plan for the state, it basically failed because the tax hikes were so high that even Democratic legislators couldn't figure out they couldn't stomach them.
So I always am up for Larry Kudlow bashing, which is obviously why I started the podcast with this.
I like him.
And
I think he's a great guy.
You know,
and
we could talk about it forever.
I think as a person,
I want to move along because, in fact, every single other person in Washington is not talking about deficits, unfortunately. Or, and I actually do want to take a minute to read this glorious headline that appeared at Reason.com, since the other thing that's going on is tariffs, which no one else is talking about. Eric Bames' headline on, you'll recall that the very first round of tariffs that went into place were on steel and aluminum. There was, but even before that, there was a tariff on imported washing machines, right? There was this, there was a washing machine moment. And so Eric Bame has written about how that worked out. And his headline is, Whirlpool took tariffs for a spin, comma, ended up with tumbling sales. Tariffs let the government pick winners and losers, but sometimes even the winners get hung out to dry. So come to Reason.com to see more of that gloriousness and know that, in fact, the exact company, I mean, this is a really narrow, you know, giving of a benefit to an American company. This is this has not generated more jobs. It has actually been bad for the primary company that makes washing machines in the United States in the long run. So just to review, tariffs are bad. And Larry Kudlow has been totally hypocritical on this point as well. He keeps saying like, well, I don't like tariffs, but Trumps are fine, I guess, now that I work for him. However, we are not talking about any more Larry Kudlow because we have to talk about these stupid memos. Okay, so everyone in Washington is completely consumed with what appears to be, you know, part 682 of the 10,000 million part series in what the hell is happening with the Russia investigation and associated investigations, because I think there are 17 or 18 now. The word imbroglio, which I never know how to pronounce it. When you see press reports using that word, that's when you know that something has gotten beyond even the like daily reporters who are trying to cover it.
That's what I'm going to name my personal Amaro.
Imbroglio.
I'm going to name it Imbroglio, and it's going to be like Chinar, but even better.
Yeah. So like, for instance, this lead at NPR this morning, a hot new document offers a sliver of new understanding to the Russia imbroglio.
Wow.
But is there actually new understanding? What
has not dislodged warring partisans from their long-term deadlock about evidence and surveillance in the case. Okay, Peter, you might know like two things. No one expects you to actually understand what's going on here, but what is in these documents and why do we give even one single fuck?
Yeah, thank you for those low expectations.
I am here for you with the low expectations.
I really honestly do appreciate them. So what basically happened here is that part of the backstory of the Russian investigation is that the FBI got a FISA warrant to wiretap look into the communications of Carter Page, who was an aide to President Trump's campaign, because the FBI was worried, had concerns that Carter Page might be in somehow or another an agent or connected to have dubious dealings with the Russian government.
I have to briefly interrupt you and say, I started listening to you talk, and then my brain like tried to shut itself down 2 sentences into your explanation.
Okay, so let's do this even shorter.
It's not your fault. It's just so terrible.
Trump foreign policy advisor, the FBI thought might be a Russian spy.
Right.
And as a result, got a FISA warrant. We all know we're libertarians. We cover FISA warrants. They're super important to like what we do. We've talked about them. This is how the government spies on you. There's a warrant process, but it's all super secret. Normally, we don't get to see into it at all.
So and super part of rubber what, stamp.
And it's a
and
rubber
large.
Stamp.
Yep. Yeah, Nick and I both got out rubber. Our matching rubber stamps there.
Yeah. Yep. And so part
Belgian
of what's interesting
Congo,
about this is that we are getting
King
to
Leopold's
see,
mine rubber stamp.
Yep. Is that we're getting to see a FISA warrant. Now, it's been heavily redacted. This was released because Trump wanted us to see at least this redacted version. The intelligence community didn't want us to see this because they never want us to see anything about what they do. That's pretty much their standard. Nope, you can never see anything. Trump wanted us to see it because Trump thinks that this proves that the entire Russia investigation is a partisan witch hunt. He believes that because what this FISA application shows is that the FBI relied heavily, though not exclusively, on the Steele dossier, which, as you may recall, is this intel dump put together by Michael Steele, some of which has proven true, not all of which, and which was at one point funded by basically by the Hillary Clinton campaign. However, it started started not as a Hillary Clinton campaign operation, but as something that was paid for by the Washington Free Beacon, our friends at a conservative website, that where they were doing oppo research on President Trump. In any case, all of this kind of doesn't matter, because whether or not this was mostly about mostly driven by the Steele dossier, the Russia investigation started because George Papadopoulos got drunk. He got drunk, which I may be already today. Because George Papadopoulos, a different Trump campaign advisor, got drunk and started bragging about the Russians having dirt on Hillary to an Australian diplomat who then eventually alerted United States intelligence officials. And so that is why there is a, whether you want to call it a witch hunt or a reasonable investigation, I think it's a pretty reasonable investigation, all things considered. But Trump thinks it's a witch hunt that is driven entirely by partisan concerns. And he thinks that if he releases this thing that shows that they relied on the Steele dossier, which was paid for by Hillary Clinton, I think that's as short as you can get it all.
Yeah.
Then everyone will believe
him. I think it's a fantastic development in this sense. My optimistic theory about the Trump presidency is that he is absolutely demystifying power in a way that both Bush and Obama did in their various levels of incompetency and lying, both directly by them to the American public and most, if not all, of their major agency heads and certainly directors of national intelligence, of the FBI, of the CIA, of the NSA, of the surveillance state. They were liars about it. And what I like about Trump, who is a destructive person, he is, he's acid that and he's pouring through the bottom of a paper coffee filter. You know, it's tearing stuff apart. I think it's great because he may or may not be compromised by Russia. And I don't think he is in any kind of like Manchurian candidate sense. But, he's a sleazy business operator and he's got a lot to answer for,
so
et cetera.
We have a fresh perspective here. Let's ask Slade, do you buy the Nick Gillespie theory that it's good to demystify the presidency?
Power. Oh, well, but if I can just to put a point on it. Like the national surveillance state is out of control. It was out of control. We learned this in the 70s, during the Church Commission hearings and other hearings, the Rockefeller Commission hearings as well. It was, FISA and other things came in to reform it. It is out of control again. And when you look at people like Kurt Wiebe and William Binney and Edward Snowden, we need this purging. Like there is something sickening about the way that the government it spies on people, and it is absolutely independent of anything that has anything to do with anything. So good, more power to this. I think it's a great development.
I will say this, that it does seem like this whole controversy turns on the question of whether the FBI or the Department of Justice claims, well, we looked at the Steele dossier, but we also really have good reason to think that that these claims are credible. And they don't go into we don't know what that means, right? We don't actually have any idea what other intel they were working off of. And so we just have to, and the courts too, the judges who approved the FISA warrants just had to trust them when they said, okay, yeah, this is sort of politicized, but we have good reason to think that it's worth pursuing. We don't know. And we can't really hold them accountable for that. We just have to trust them. The courts just have to trust them. And that's kind of the problem with all of this, is that it's all being done behind a curtain in a way.
And the idea of revealing one redacted FISA document and saying, like, look, it vindicates, the idea that this was a witch hunt. And also, and I've seen this sort of floating around the internet, is this a move for transparency? Does this, because we typically don't see these documents at all, does the choice to release it mean that this is in some way a blow for openness or open government? I think it's tough to make the case. It's certainly selective and political, but sometimes that's the best transparency we can get.
Don't you agree, though, that it opens up? Because it's not about this one document. And we have to look at this in sequence where, you had Barack Obama. And this is the type of thing where Barack Obama, to everybody, looks, retroactively or retrodictively. It's like, he wasn't so bad. He was terrible on this. And he only copped to having expanded Bush's, you know, various Bush surveillance programs of American citizens without any kind of warrant, without any kind of restraint after Edward Snowden blew the whistle on him. And then he was like, you know, I would love to have a national conversation about surveillance while after spending his entire presidency lying that it was even happening. I think, again, it's not about Carter Page and it's not about Trump. It is about we desperately need a reset. And I think before we get there, we're going to reach rock bottom, and it's going to be an open war. It's already a pretty open war between the executive branch and the surveillance state. And it's going to get worse, and it's going to drag down a lot of congressional people. I mean, think about it. We just found out a couple months ago that Congress had a slush fund to pay off like horny old congressmen, you know, claims against horny congressmen like John Conyers out of tax money for people that they were molesting. This is like, we have a long way to go before transparency even starts to, you know, get past the grammar school
level. Yeah, but I'm not sure that this...
I think it's all to the good.
I don't know that this memo is going to help us get there because you know, it is possible that the Department of Justice had really good reasons to be doing this investigation, to be seeking this authority.
Why do you have trust in the government? Like, what more does the government have to do? And I'm not like a nihilist about the government, but the surveillance apparatus.
The point is, though, that we can't know what evidence they had. Maybe they had good evidence. Maybe they didn't have good evidence. We have no way of knowing. But so what the problem with this situation is that it becomes just a Rorschach test where if you like Trump, you're inclined to trust Trump. He says this memo is a smoking gun. You assume it is. If you don't like Trump, you're inclined to believe the worst about Trump or about government more generally, then you look at this and you say it's bullshit. That's just the way it works because we don't have enough evidence to know what the right answer is yet.
And I would just add on the evidence front, it's the memo, the FISA warrant here that is released says that basically the FBI believed that Carter Page, again, the guy who the Trump advisor who's in question here, had been targeted by the Russian government and had established relationships with Russian government officials, including Russian intelligence officers, and perhaps had even been collaborating and conspiring with them. Carter Page in 2013 admitted to being an informal advisor to the staff of the Kremlin and said he'd sat in on meetings with the Kremlin. This is a guy who, by his own admission, had dealings with Russian intelligence officers. So the FBI wasn't crazy, wasn't just making things up. They were taking Carter Page at his word.
What will it take for you guys to say, why not, in 1980, the Libertarian Party ticket, which was Ed Clark as president and David Koch, a trustee of the Reason Foundation as vice president, they ran on a campaign in 1980 that included the abolition of the FBI and the CIA. What's it going to take for you guys to get back to that clarion moment where it's not that we don't need intelligence services, but like the FBI, and I highly recommend reading Tim Weiner's Enemies, a Long History, where it turns out that, J. Edgar Hoover wasn't the worst FBI director. Louis Freeh comes in for more shellacking, for just abusing power. The NSA has an unbroken record of spying on Americans and surpassing what its legal mandates to surveil people without probable cause or without, rationale.
We have
the CIA is an incompetent organization that up until the minute that, the fucking Soviet Union collapsed, they were like, the Soviet Union is doing really well. I think they're going to win the American League pennant. I mean, like, these are terrible organizations that routinely lie and are incompetent.
I agree that the intelligence community has abused its power over and over again, in particular with regard to surveillance of regular American citizens.
And we write that all the time.
But when a super shady businessman with clear connections to Russian oligarchs hires a campaign aide who has admitted to sitting in on meetings with Russian intelligence officials, that actually seems to me to be the proper thing that the intelligence community should be investigating on a regular basis rather than sweeping up zillions of communications from people like us.
About whether or not we have, used the drugs. Yeah. So, as always, Nick, we are honored to have you as our one true Scotsman on the podcast. I want to change topics real quick,
I'm the least libertarian on the podcast.
Alexandria.
I'm a big government libertarian.
Ocasio Cortez. I want to talk about AOC, as she is now known to her fans and enemies, which, by the way, every time I see that, I think it's like, you know, the thing on the label of a bottle of wine that tells you it's like champagne is really from the Champagne region. It's AOC. So she's super authentic, I guess. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is the new hot thing in the socialist scene. But it's not hard to be the new hot thing in the socialist scene when the other hot thing in the socialist scene is Bernie Sanders. She has come in for scrutiny the way that a rising political star sometimes does, including a post by our own Robbie Suave, in which he takes issue with her claim that unemployment is low because, quote, everyone has two jobs. Robbie notes that this is not how unemployment figures work. There's been some meta conversation, though, about whether we're allowed to talk about a young female person of color in this way. Slade, you're a lady. What do you think? Are we allowed to talk about, are we allowed to go after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for her lack of economic literacy?
I mean, I would say absolutely not, unless, except the fact that she's running for public office. I mean, I don't see how this could possibly be objectionable. She's put herself out as a public figure. She's even tweeted sort of, you know, jokingly and braggadociously about how she studied economics in college and like, where are the rest of my, you know, members of Congress who studied economics so we can start a club together, as if she's already in Congress, which she's obviously not. It's not unreasonable. I don't know why this is a controversy at all. It's not unreasonable to question somebody who's asking for your vote or who's holding themselves out as a public figure in the political sort of realm.
Peter, how dumb is it to say unemployment is low because people are, and the full quote is, because people are working 60, 70, 80 hours a week and can barely feed their kids, and then also because people are working two jobs. Is that how unemployment figures work?
It's not really how employment figures work. I mean, the unemployment figures right now are actually kind of interesting. Throughout the Obama administration, we had arguments about which unemployment figure was correct. And Trump said at one point that it was actually true unemployment. It's something like 44%. There are that to be clear, Trump falsely claimed that true unemployment was something like 42 or 44%, to use the correct New York Times headline style, without evidence, Trump claims. So there's been debates about which unemployment measure to use. And in fact, we now have typically we talk about unemployment as the people who are looking for a job who don't have one. But then there's also a measure of workforce participation, and workforce participation had been getting worse throughout the Obama administration. And now we have the highest workforce participation since 2003. The reason that unemployment is up is because more people are working. That includes more people who want a job, and there are in fact more people who have come into the job search market of wanting a job and wanting to work. Now, it is true that wages are continuing to be stagnant in some ways, and so, you know, if you're a socialist type, if you're a that is a cause for concern. The people sort of at the bottom end of the income ladder are not making more money, they're not being paid more. Employers aren't raising wages, basically. But the pressure is now getting to the point where it really starts to look like employers are going to have to. The worry, I think, though, is that the trade war that Trump has started is going to dampen the good economy. And in fact, the Tax Foundation put out a report within the last week or so, basically saying this Tax Foundation, I should be clear, has been quite positive about Trump's tax cuts, and has said really these are really going to boost the economy. And they said that the effect of the trade war could in fact completely kill all of the positive effects of the Trump tax cut.
What is Ocasio-Cortez's position on tariffs? Because what she is doing, or what she apes, and it's the same thing that Bernie Sanders, like, they promised tariffs. They promised protectionism. They promised everything that they could to bring back industrial jobs to America. So she, to the extent that she has anything to say about that, she's going to be in line with Trump. I think it is absolutely the case that she's 28. She has a dual degree in like economics and international relations. And she also really stepped up to her waist and shit about Israel, which she obviously knows nothing about the symbolic language that Democratic candidates are supposed to use about that. She comes across as an idiot who, and if you look at her platform, it is, we are going to have the government give you more and more and more and more and more and more stuff. And like Bernie Sanders, we'll tax billionaires and we're going to get rid of all those extra flavors of deodorant that are weighing down the economy and distracting us from, you know, having Cadillac healthcare for everybody. To the extent, if she is the future of progressive Democratic candidates, I think the future is looking better and better for libertarian-minded Democrats, Republicans, and libertarians who will say the government should be doing less, it should be spending less, and it should be less in your face. Because she is, you know, she's not going to be able to make a convincing case for paying for all of the shit that she says.
Well, this just goes back to what I was saying about the tax cuts and the deficits. And if you look at what she's running on, you know, it's a jobs guarantee and Medicare for all and really very expansive big government programs. And she's talked a little bit about rolling back some of the reduction in the corporate tax cut to pay for this. That doesn't get you nearly far enough. But basically, the argument from this part of the Democratic Party is already and is increasingly going to be, why do we need to pay for this stuff? Republicans didn't pay for their tax cuts. They didn't worry about the deficit or the debt at all. It was all of those concerns that, you know, Paul Ryan and everybody else mounted during the Obama era were totally fake. And in fact, look, they ran up the deficit and the economy was great. Let's do more of that. That's what they're going to say. And I think that I worry that there is going to be an increasingly large constituency for that argument.
Slade, do people struggle to feed their kids because of, quote, no holds barred capitalism? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
No, obviously that's not true. If anything, capitalism brings down the prices and, you know, increases the variety and amazing access to all kinds of awesome things all the time. You know, walk into a grocery store in America versus the Soviet Union or whatever. I mean, this is not, again, it's like amazing that this is an argument that still has to be had. But I guess it is.
So here we are. Let's have it again.
You know, the Democrats keep flirting with and nominating and potentially electing socialists. So I guess we're going to have this argument again.
But they're not. I mean, they don't even have the courage of their convictions. They're not socialists. They're not saying, you know, fuck Whirlpool. We're, you know, the government should be running washing machine factories and stuff like that. And the wrong Slade, you're absolutely right. You know, in 2000, I think it was like 2013 or 2014, Bernie Sanders said nobody who works 40 hours a week should be living in poverty. Guess what? Nobody who works 40 hours a week is living in poverty. And we need to, you know, like there's so much like ephemeral, not ephemeral reality, but like fake conceptions of what is real out there. People are in pain. People are suffering. People need more opportunities. They're not going to get it from somebody who doesn't understand basic economics and is saying, you know, what we really need to do is to triple the outlays of government, which would probably be what it would cost to pay for her program, and then everything will be okay. We need to have a conversation about how do you help people who are struggling without fucking up everything else? And how do you bring down the costs of healthcare and education and retirement and all of the things that government is heavily, heavily involved in. And this is one of the reasons I like somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because she's going to foreground that argument. And they will lose. They will lose that argument because in the end, people might be self-interested, but they're not idiots.
My favorite story
about
the fall of the Soviet Union is when Boris Yeltsin came to Texas and went into a grocery store. It was an unplanned stop, and he went into a Randall's grocery store in Texas. And he just, like, the reports from, this is in 1999, and the reports of him, like, and there are photos as well of him wandering around the food aisles, just being like, oh my goodness. The quote from one of the reports at the time is that he roamed the aisles of Randall's, nodding his head in amazement, and told his advisors and some of the other people who were with him that if any of the people in Russia saw the condition of U.S. supermarkets, quote, there would be a revolution. Even the Politburo doesn't have this choice. Not even Mr. Gorbachev, right? And it was just this, like, amazement at there are 14 different kinds of Freezy Pops, and oh my goodness, look at all of the different variations on Cheerios, right? It is that. It's 42 different types of deodorant is what kills communism.
This is the perfect segue into our What Are You Consuming segment of our podcast, in which we talk about the products of late stage capitalism that we enjoy. Slade, why don't you go first since you are a special guest star?
Sure. So I recently came back from a vacation to Europe. And while I was there, I visited the Chartreuse Valley in southern France, which is the home to the Carthusian Catholic Monastery, where the monks make, and they are the only people on earth who know how to make and do produce Chartreuse liquor or liqueur. Although, as we discovered in the office last week, it is stronger than your normal liqueur. It is much more like a full-on liquor. So I brought some back. I brought back a bunch of varieties, including a small bottle of what they call the Chartreuse Elixir. This is actually the original sort of invention back in, I think, the 17th century. They had this recipe and they made it and they produced this elixir that they treated as medicine, and they still actually market it as a medicinal product. It's very, very high proof and very strong.
That it did not increase my health status.
Maybe because we were mixing it with all those other liquors and beers that we were drinking at the same time.
Do you drink Chartreuse by itself, or it's usually a mix?
You can drink it by itself, but yeah, it's very sweet. Yeah. It's very herbal and very sweet, and so I think Peter would have many ideas about what what you might mix it into to produce a delicious and wonderful cocktail.
So did you go to, this is like your whole Catholicism slate is like a cover so that you can go to the great like booze making sites all over the world? Because Catholics, and as somebody who was raised Catholic, one of the things I still take pride in is how much good beer, wine, and liquor the Catholic Church is involved.
Yeah, I also spent two nights at a Trappist abbey where they make beer. So yes.
I'm converting.
Did you? Was it silent? Did you do the? Was it a silent place or anything like that?
Other than the seven times a day that we pray together, it was basically silent. Yes.
Did you find that a fascinating or transformative, interesting experience?
It was. It was very interesting. It was nice to get away. Although it was pretty funny. I checked into the abbey, thinking that I was going to be on this like silent retreat, and I was going to get away from everything and leave, you know, the news cycle behind. And the first thing that happened is the monk who runs. He's the hotelier. He's the person who greets guests and shows them to their rooms. He handed me a slip of paper with a Wi-Fi password on it, so I wasn't as far away from the world as I thought I was going to be.
It's just that scene in Doctor Strange.
I don't know what that scene in Doctor Strange is.
There's a scene in which he goes to the psychic monk facility to train to be Doctor Strange, and they put him up in his little hotel and hand him like a slip, and he's like, is this like some sort of secret, mystical? And he's like, no, it's the Wi-Fi password. We're not monsters.
Was the password like INRI or something? I mean, is it a clever joke on Catholic iconography?
Yeah, probably.
Peter, what are you consuming?
I saw a preview screening of Mission Impossible Fallout over the weekend. I saw it on an IMAX screen, and so a couple of the big sequences.
Did you lose a bet or something?
No, I saw
what,
this.
What kind of dossier does Tom Cruise have on you that you're watching Mission Impossible 10?
Well, it's the sixth one, and the series has really been rebooted and reimagined, starting with number three, but really with number four, into just a kind of series of incredible actual physical stunts. And in particular, there's two big sequences that were shot on actual IMAX cameras that really benefit from the format. In one of them, Tom Cruise, I was about to say President Trump, Tom Cruise does a halo jump out of an airplane. And so it's a very low altitude jump. Tom Cruise actually just did that. He trained for 3 weeks doing eight jumps a day. And then they had a 4 minute window to catch the exact perfect light. It was the last 4 minutes of light. And so he jumps out of like a C-130 type plane with a guy holding another parachuter, holding an IMAX camera pointed at him the whole time. They catch this whole thing, and then there's like a mid-air fight sequence. It's shown in sort of the biggest, the highest resolution on the biggest screen. I saw it in one of the biggest screens in Washington. And then the movie ends with a helicopter duel that is just delightful. And so if you're a fan, I mean, the movie doesn't make any sense, but if you're a fan of really big physical action stunt work and not all CGI action sequences, it really works pretty well. And I really like where the franchise has gone.
How does a studio allow, why would they allow Tom Cruise to do something like that? I mean, it's it just seems to beggar the imagination.
You can take any risk with the right insurance package, friend.
So they there's
yeah, maybe they would come out ahead.
Very expensive insurance, but also Tom Cruise is an executive producer. He does all of these things through his own sort of little sub studio. And so this is in many ways Cruise's signature over the last 5 to 10 years is that he is doing these big stunts himself for Mission Impossible 4 in particular. Right. He actually climbed on the outside of the Burj Khalifa, the world's tallest building,
that was,
for a couple of days.
That now, was, he was that was to a nerve-wracking ride. To watch.
But the reason it looks so great is because there's a camera on the outside of the Burj Khalifa. There's Tom Cruise actually on the outside of the Burj Khalifa at the top of it. And then there's all of this space below them. And it looks like that because that's what it is. And so it just looks kind of incredible in a way that a lot of action movies don't.
Nick, give us, your,
make,
give us
your. I want to talk more about Tom Cruise, and I have a Scientology question for Peter. That I just very quickly, will Battlefield Earth, you know, get a reboot with John Travolta and Tom Cruise and the woman from Mad Men, who's now in the Handmaid's Tale? There's so many good Scientologist actors these days.
Nick, what are your recommendations? Give them to us quick, baby.
All right. So I'm reread Jean-Francois Lyotard's 1984 book, published in English in 84, The Postmodern Condition, A Report on Knowledge, as well as Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism by Frederick Jameson, because I'm working on a piece to talk about why libertarianism and particularly Hayekian versions of libertarianism are very simpatico with postmodernism. And the current rants from people like Jordan Peterson and a bunch of even less informed kind of intellectual dark web people who rail against postmodernism are getting it very wrong in a way that I think is bad for discourse. But it will also there's a postmodern version of libertarianism that Reason, I think, has been expounding in its first 50 years. That we should clarify and really, really embrace, or at least investigate.
I'm up for any fight, intellectual or physical, between you and Jordan Peterson. So that sounds pretty good, I have to say. I recommend a new podcast that I'm listening to called Family Ghosts. It's a Panoply podcast by a guy who is a friend of mine, full disclosure, Sam Dingman. And the pilot episode is a story about his family that involves a one-eyed blonde named Sabina, who turns out to be a jewel thief and who eventually runs away to Sao Paulo, I think, or Rio, somewhere, and has an anchor baby there to avoid being deported. And this is like the long-lost step-grandmother of our narrator. And every single episode is a similarly sort of fascinating and outlandish story about things in people's families' pasts that they have not fully excavated until the occasion of this podcast. It is like super classy podcast version of the Jerry Springer Show, and I recommend it to you all.
I can't wait till the Guar episode.
Yes, coming soon to a podcast near you. Speaking of podcasts near you, this has been the Reason Podcast. Thank you to Stephanie Slade, Peter Suderman, and Nick Gillespie. No thank you to Matt Welsh, who has buggered off somewhere in France. We will be back next week with more exciting Monday talk show. But in the meantime, there will be interviews and other exciting podcasts from Nick and his gang, including many taped at Freedom Fest. If you like what you heard today, you should go to iTunes. You should subscribe. You should rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.